And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Before I go to my two guests in the studio, and indeed, if you do want to get questions in relation to the referendum results, do get them in straight away to 086 38 33 553. That is our text and WhatsApp number. Thanks to rational.ie. You can also phone Fiona on reception on 0917 700 077 and email comments at goibfm.ie. A comment from Friday morning's programme in relation to the Palestinian journalist we had on. It was so moving to hear this Palestinian woman talking about her lived experience of the situation in Gaza. The international community must put pressure on both sides to stop the war. As always, it is the innocent, everyday men, women and children who just want to live in peace who are suffering. It is horrendous. Now, though, I'm delighted to say I'm joined in studio this morning by Green Party Senator Pauline O'Reilly and ANTU Representative Luke Silk. You're both very welcome into studio today. And Luke, I might start with you first, because the winner takes it all, and ANTU are the only political party to advocate for a no-no vote in the referendums.
Yes, absolutely, John. I take great reassurance in that we were able to, I suppose, accurately read the mood of the people. And that we are in touch with the people. In my own home parish, outside Tuam there in Barnagarrig, where I went to national school, that ballot box returned an 88% no on the family referendum.
Wow.
So, it's not just, obviously, a great day for my political party, for ANTU, but also, I think, for family carers around the country and for people with disabilities and their families. Who had grave concerns about the care referendum and were, I suppose, protesting this wording and looking for an alternative that was better. So I think they got their message across as well, and that it does send a message to government now that we don't want virtue signalling or promotion of values or kind of empty, meaningless things like that. We want tangible supports for people who are providing care in the home, and we need supports in that regard in relation to the carer's allowance and so on.
And we're also joined by Senator Pauline O'Reilly of the Green Party. Senator O'Reilly, ye and government and all the political parties, bar ANTU and a few independent senators and others, were advocating for a yes vote in the referendum, and there was a really resounding response from the people for no. Where did government, where did the different parties in government get it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there has to be a period of reflection. I think there's a huge array of reasons that people voted no to the two referendums. And as you say, every political party will have to think about that. But, you know, all of the civil society groups as well will have to think about that. I just want to say, though, that, you know, it's important to say that everybody who came out, whether they were voting yes or they were voting no, I just want to thank them all. I think it's really important to have our say. Now, these referendums in particular, the care one has been on the cards for 30 years. And indeed, I've heard of many politicians in the past saying it was just too complex to put to the people. We have put to the people. People have spoken. But it doesn't mean that the other kinds of policies that need to happen don't need to happen now. I mean, we have to listen and try then to put into place the things and the supports that people want. But I think for some, the wording didn't go far enough. For some, the wording was too, went too far, was too liberal. And so I suppose it's about really doing all we can to move forward with policies that make people's lives better.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there that it mightn't have been the right thing to put to the people. Was it a lack of understanding among the public or what?
I think that would be unfair to say. You know, I think that citizens read the information and then they make their decision. And I wouldn't like to say that anyone didn't know what they were voting for. I think that wouldn't be the right thing to say. All of the wording that I've seen, and I've been looking at this for many years, all of the wording that I've seen has been pored over, and every piece of wording has had challenges. So it was 9 months to come up with this final piece of wording, but in fact it was many years deciding over other wording in the past.
Yeah. I think one point that Senator Michael McDougall made about it was the whole idea of changing the language in the Constitution and then legal challenges being made and precedent being set that way. Was that something you think was a big turning point in it?
I think one of the difficulties is that the vast majority of lawyers would disagree with him on that, but Michael McDougall does have a very strong voice, and it is, you know, he's very well respected. I mean, I respect him myself. We'd have to disagree on this point, mm-hmm. because, you know, as a lawyer myself, I think that when you're looking at the Constitution, it's the courts that really look at the Constitution. That's natural, that's normal. So when we talk about the Constitution in the Dáil or the Seanad, we're always talking about how the courts will interpret something. Mm. But a Constitution is a tiny, tiny document. I actually said to my kids before I was going to debate last week, have you seen the Constitution anywhere? I was looking for it in the house, and the kids said, how could you fit the whole Constitution in our house? And when I showed them actually the size of it, the size of a children's book, they were shocked, because that's not really where legislation is made. Mm. And that's not really where decisions are made. Decisions are made in our legal system, in common law, in the courts, and also in a general understanding of words in society. But, you know, it did create, I think, in people's minds, doubt as to what those words would eventually mean. And I totally understand that feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to listen to that.
And one of the big ones as well, Luke, in terms of the family one in particular that was raised, and it's become a wedge issue and will be a wedge issue as we head into elections as well. Immigration and how the family amendment would have affected that if it was challenged in the courts.
Yeah, I think that was, I think there were a multitude of reasons why people came out and voted no, but that would certainly have been part of it. I think as well, a lot of people were looking at, I suppose, the campaign the government were running. And we're unhappy with that, and especially in the context of the now leaked Attorney General advice. You know, we had government ministers arguing with us when ANC leader Padraig Tobin would argue that, you know, it might have implications in these areas. Government ministers such as Roderick O'Gorman and others were saying no, and they weren't just saying no, they were saying no, we've very clear legal advice that it won't. And what we've seen in the Attorney General's advice seems to contradict that. The other thing I would say about the Attorney General's advice is, I suppose, a broader comment on the political nature of the Office of the Attorney General throughout successive governments, not just this one. Where you look at the advice, it's almost as if, you know, he's trying to see how can these amendments be worded in such a way so as to save the government money, so that it won't have ramifications for social welfare and stuff like that. And I heard someone on the radio, a law lecturer, I believe, in NUIG, who was saying, why don't we have amendments to the Constitution? Why don't we have enthusiasm within the Office of the Attorney General to promote rights-based amendments where people would be entitled to gain their rights through the courts or otherwise for financial benefits that would assist them in their own lives? Mm. So that's one of the big issues, I think. That
Do you want to respond to that, Senator Riley? Obviously very frustrating for us in the broadcast media with the moratorium, in fact that we couldn't actually jump on that leaked document from the Attorney General's.
Yeah, I mean, what the Attorney General's, what the leak, and obviously I hadn't seen it until I saw it come 2 minutes after the moratorium, yeah. which meant broadcast media couldn't discuss it, was very clear. The headlines in the papers showed it was very clear that it was saying that more supports would be there for carers in particular and for the most vulnerable if these referendums passed, in particular the care one. And that was quite clear from that Attorney General's advice. It's not for an Attorney General to be enthusiastic or otherwise about what goes into a constitution. It's for the Attorney General to give clear advice to a government, and in the end of the day, to the state, which it has done on behalf of the state in relation to Gaza and Israel as well, on an international stage. So it's not for it to get involved in politics. It's to say, would these referendums actually achieve? Would these referendums actually achieve more in terms of giving people more rights? And it was quite clear from that advice that yes, it would. Mm. And we were all pushing for a yes, not having seen that legal advice, mm-hmm. but believing that it would give people more rights, particularly carers and the most vulnerable. And I think it was a frustration, for all of us, that it was leaked in the way that it was leaked to the publication that it was as well, and that only the newspapers then could speak about it the next day because they're not broadcast media. Yeah. But in a way, it was too late at that stage in order for the public to see that. So, I mean, I definitely think that was an error. Mm. And it did have an impact. And unfortunately, it had an impact that people didn't have that information.
Yeah. You mentioned there that it would have brought more rights for carers and people with disabilities. But we did have, and there obviously was a silent majority of people as well, whether they're all from that sector or not, that were advocating for a yes-no vote as well. We had Anne-Marie Flanagan on last week in relation to that. And I suppose a lot of the criticism of it, the word strive in the care amendment, and basically that it was very watered down to be put into the constitution, not strong enough for people, because we know the history of the state in Ireland in terms of care of people, particularly in institutions, and it has been lacking since the foundation of the state.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, the legal advice was clear that strive was much stronger than what's in there already. And even if you were to look at the wording of the Citizens' Assembly, the wording of the Gender Equality Committee, which I'm part of, and as are all opposition, the wording there was take reasonable measures, which I think would have been problematic as well. So there was no wording, I think, that people were putting forward, I think, that wouldn't have been somewhat problematic, but it was stronger than what's there already. But I think what is coming out quite strongly, and I think it's really important, is that despite none of those groups in terms of the Citizens' Assembly, in terms of the Gender Equality Committee, mentioning disability at all, that people did feel that was really important to have rights for disabled people mentioned if you're mentioning care. And I think that it is about moving forward with the other policy changes that the Citizens' Assembly and that ourselves and the Gender Equality Committee, and that indeed the government has been making moves on in terms of the Disability Action Plan. Continuing to move forward with those things isn't dependent on the Constitution. Perhaps people would have had a stronger case, but this is about moving forward with the policies.
We'll go over to Luke just to give you a chance, and we might get Senator O'Reilly some water in the meantime as well. But Luke, having the referendums on International Women's Day, what did you make of that move by government?
Well, I think that, you know, it was kind of viewed as cynical. And I think speaking to many of the people, members of the public in recent times, there was a sense of frustration over these amendments. And I think a lot of, would say, female voters in particular, we're looking at it with a sense of irony, you know, the idea that we're having this conversation about a woman's place in the home when there are so many women in the country who actually don't have a home. There are so many people of my own age who feel that, you know, it's almost a given now that we'll never own a house within our own lifetimes. And then, you know, you look at the disability issues and that. I think carer's allowance was a big one. And some of the commentary from ministers, such as Heather Humphreys, such as Roderick O'Gorman, almost hinting or suggesting that, you know, we look at these issues if there is a yes. Now, I appreciate that Pauline is saying they're going to look at them anyway, but it was almost a cynical ploy to try and entice people to get to vote yes by dangling money in front of them. And the carer's allowance is a huge issue, you know, in terms of the qualification criteria. You know, you might be a mother looking after a child with severe disabilities and you're there 24/7, and just because your spouse is on a high income, you don't get paid at all for providing that care. You're also, if you do qualify for the carer's allowance, you're almost prohibited from taking a part-time job at the weekend because you'll disqualify yourself by doing that. So I think there's a lot of issues there that really need to be sorted out. The issues of youth emigration, young people going abroad. Again, we're talking about our place at home, but there's so many that feel forced from their homes due to the economic circumstances and things like that. And I think transport. You know, I'm a big advocate for the reopening, and Aoife would be as well, for the reopening of the Western Rail Corridor. And I think it's not lost on anyone that, you know, there are young parents who want to spend time with their children but are stuck in traffic, particularly in Galway, for hours every day. And that is time that they would like to spend at home. So I think the reopening of the Western Rail Corridor should be a priority for government as well, in order to allow people to spend more time at home with their families and with their children.
Yeah, do you want to respond to that, Senator O'Reilly? Just cynical to hold it on International Women's Day?
I think all of the issues, there's an awful lot of issues there. Yeah. Plus, as Luke knows, we are, and the Green Party have pushed for the reopening of the Western Rail Corridor, but I'm not sure that came up during this, to be perfectly frank, for me. I think it's a separate issue. But in relation to holding it on International Women's Day, it certainly was nothing to do with me or us. I think that it's been spoken about for so long, and it had to happen at some time. But I think, you know, it's unfair to say that government, I've never heard anybody in government say, we'll only look at these things if this passes. I mean, nobody has said that I have heard from at all. People have said, we have to do all of these things as well, but here's a separate thing, which is a referendum, in order to, I suppose, outline what the values of Ireland are. And I totally take on board Luke's point that maybe people don't want to talk about those values. They're not really that interested in the referendum, but I actually think a lot of people were interested in both. That you absolutely have to move forward with policy changes. We're doing it anyway. It should be done anyway. But I do think that there's absolutely a sense of real anger and real frustration when it comes to those who are disabled in society and having access to supports. And in terms of being at home, like, I was a stay-at-home mother for nearly 10 years myself. I absolutely know that nothing was done to support that kind of care either. So, you know, I don't think that this referendum stops or pushes any more to be done, but I think it has to be done anyway.
Yeah. There was an accusation from the likes of Senator Gerard Crochwell and others in relation to how quickly the referendum was being pushed through both houses of the Oireachtas, and that there was a challenge coming against the current wording that could have implications if it were to succeed. And we'll obviously see that in the next coming weeks and months. But would you accept that? Was that a reason for it to be rushed through?
There was no rushing through. I don't accept that there was a rushing through, because I sat on a gender equality committee for 9 months, and at the end of that, and with the wording that the government put forward, every single one of the gender equality committee, and that's right across independents like Alice Mary Higgins, three members of Sinn Féin, all supported a yes, yes vote, having looked at these details and having seen and accepted the wording coming from government. Every time we're in the Seanad or the Dáil, we put forward amendments. Some get through, some don't. That's the nature of politics. Mm. But in the end of the day, you have to make a decision based on what's in front of you as to whether you're going to vote yes or no, and whether you're going to ask your electorate to do it. And Aon Tú were the only ones who said no. In fact, the only one who said no to either of the amendments. So, you know, that is the reality. That's where we are. And they saw what it was. But I think in relation to Gerard Crochwell, I mean, I did debate him on this station during this as well. And he was asked multiple times by Keith Finnegan, was he supporting a yes or a no? And he didn't answer the question. So, you know, people do have to, I suppose, be honest about, they've looked at the wording and what do they feel. And that's our job as politicians. But I definitely I'm listening to everybody, their reasons for voting no. And I think there's a lot of important concerns that people have.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I do think the legislation was rushed in terms of the waiving of pre-legislative scrutiny, a normal process with the progress of legislation through the House, and as well as at the guillotining of the bills within the Dáil. I also thought it was very interesting to look at the Count Centre over the weekend at the ballots from rural areas, and just the high percentage of no's coming out of rural Ireland. And I think that's because people in rural areas feel neglected by the government. And I think as well, a kind of an anti-green sentiment there in rural Ireland, that we feel abandoned, we feel neglected. In Galway East, for example, we feel that our two government TDs are not visiting our part of the constituency in the Tuam area. We're having public meetings on issues and they're not showing up. So that could be part of it as well. But yeah, I do feel
that
the process
is they can't be everywhere. They can't be everywhere, the government TDs.
I know, but like when you have three public meetings in the space of a week, as we did on the topic of wind farms at home in Maelá and in Barnagearraig and in the Ard-Righ in Tuam, all the councillors were there, but only independent TD Sean Canny was there. There was no Ciarán Cannon. I think Anne Rabbitt turned up to one of them, but they're not engaging with their constituents. And this is what the constituents are telling me, that they feel neglected by the government in terms of the cost of petrol, the cost of living crisis. Farmers feel punished in terms of the carbon tax. All these issues, they feel that there's a disconnect between us and Dublin, and that Dublin really isn't listening to rural Ireland. And they do seem to be appreciative of Aon Tú for standing up for these causes and things like that. And sometimes it does feel like I'm the only one. And in the referendum campaign, for example, I very much felt when I was engaging with the media or when I was engaging on social media and other things that I was going against the wind, that I was in the minority. Now, perhaps that is because the entire political establishment, all the political parties except my own, were lined up against us, and a great quantity of the NGOs as well. So I think that might be in part why I felt like I was going against the wind. But by God, we got our answer at the weekend, where, you know, upwards of around 70% in both came out. And it feels, you know, AINTHU was the only party really that was on, that correctly judged the public mood on this one.
The real question is, will this have an impact on the upcoming local and European elections? Senator O'Reilly, do you think it will? Or we've seen in the past that people tend to vote very differently when it does come to elections.
Yeah, well, I think, as I was saying, Luke and I were discussing this outside, and I don't think, and neither of us, I think, feel that this is directly related to local elections or European elections. And I think it was pointed out by the Taoiseach that it's never had an impact. I think 11 referendums have been defeated.
Yeah.
Defeated maybe is the wrong word. People have asked a question and people have voted no, and it didn't have an impact on the elections. I think really this is about being responsible and looking and listening to people. What are the things that are at the moment, things that are concerning people? But, I mean, you still have to stand, you have to stand up for your values. And it's not just about judging a mood and then going with that mood. It's about saying, this is who we are as a party. This is what we have to offer. This is who we are as individual politicians. And even if something is unpopular, that you still have to say it and then have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not going to answer for the other politicians in Galway East because I'm not there. And we don't have anybody elected in Galway East. But I certainly think that there's an onus on everybody to listen to their constituents, absolutely, and to have those conversations.
Yeah, and the last point I want to make on it, and it's one thing that people went against what the government was advocating for, and nearly all political parties buy into in terms of a yes, yes campaign vote. But they also went against the likes of NGOs, such as the National Women's Council and different things. And we're hearing this morning that there's deep fissures in different NGO groups now following the results in the referendum.
I can't really answer for those groups. I mean, all of the trade unions, the Students' Union, the Women's Rights Organisations, Children's Rights Alliance, they were all on a yes, yes side as well. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of conversations to be had. But I also think that there are a variety of reasons people voted the way that they did. I don't think there's one singular group of people who have one very strong message. I think it's lots of individual groups, as I said at the start, some who believed that it was too progressive, that they've had enough, and some who believed it wasn't progressive enough. And that's, I guess that's a challenge for every organisation when there's no one clear message.
Do you want to touch on that as well?
Yeah, well, just on the electoral issue, as Pauline said, I don't think it will have, there's a direct correlation between election results and referendum results.
Yeah.
But we would certainly be feeling, I'd be feeling more confident going into the local elections now, looking at this result. And also my party leader, Padraig Tobin, is running in the Midlands Northwest constituency as well. So he would be feeling confident as well, I suppose, the profile that he got. Being the only TD and the only party AINTHU to advocate a no vote. But what I would like to say to the people of Galway is that it is very important to exercise your democratic rights. And what we saw in action over the weekend was democracy. And if you're unhappy with the government, vote against the government and vote for other parties, vote for other candidates such as myself or anyone that would challenge the political establishment. I did not put my hand in the air and find which way the wind was blowing. I read the amendments in depth. And I saw the flaws with them when it came to families and carers. I also had concerns about the single parents perhaps being omitted from the term durable relationships. So, you know, that was kind of, I didn't just stick my hand in the air. I didn't just judge the mood of the public. I came to my own decision and our party came to our own decision as well.
I'll just bring you some of the comments before we go. It was all gobbledygook, John, that says one of our listeners. Hi, John. Fair play to the politicians for publicising that vote and for fronting up when the result doesn't go their way. I wasn't engaged in this issue personally. Too technical and abstract for me. We're a long way from a society like Switzerland where people routinely vote on these issues and it seems the civic engagement is very high there. Would that be a good model for us, do your guests think? And also the plural of referendum is referenda, and the media and the government need to accept the reality of the result, that the people have voted and the people are right. As a full-time carer, I'm so relieved this referendum was defeated. People like Tom Clunan are the only ones that speak for carers, not other voices who have no interest in carers' rights. I don't hear a word from anyone in government about the means test that stops people doing 24/7 care and no recognition for it. Good morning, John. The work of politicians, both local and national, is not to read the mood of the people and then decide on this mood which is the best to advise the people. They did not listen to the advice of the Attorney General, and they did not listen to the advice of the former Attorney General, who advised them that the present wording was the best. If politicians won't heed the advice of learned lawyers, then God help the people of Ireland. And they just keep coming in and coming in and coming in, and I just need to check a lot of them that are coming in. But do you want to respond to anything that you've heard there, Senator O'Reilly, first?
Yeah, but just to reiterate, I don't believe that, you know, that it is about getting something right or wrong in terms of the mood of the people. I think you have to listen to the people, but you still have to be honest about what you think is the right thing to do in a situation and go to people with that level of honesty. I mean, I was in a debate last week where I said, look, I believe that what's in there at the moment is sexist, and I'll put across why I believe that. But in the end of the day, it's your decision. If you don't, and if you think that it's fine, then you can vote no, and that's completely up to you. Mm-hmm. And people have done that. But, you know, in terms of the Attorney General, I think, you know, the one publication that got it, I think if you read down through it, it's quite clear that what the Attorney General said was that it would give people a better ability to fight for more financially. And so it was on that basis that actually it would do more than, mm-hmm. than what's currently there, that I was backing it. Because that's what I believed anyway, without having seen the advice. Mm-hmm. Different lawyers are going to say different things, like, but the majority of lawyers believed that it was strong enough. I think that perhaps, you know, we do need to look at that engagement piece. I think it would be unfair to say that nobody understood what they were voting for. I don't think that's the case. Mm-hmm. I think they did. Some people felt very strongly. Some people have said to me, these are not the things that we should be putting into a constitution. Mm-hmm. And I take that on board as well.
There's also people giving out about the cost of the referenda, 20 million spent.
Mm. Yeah, and the majority of that that's on the staffing required for the count centres is actually the majority of that. And it, like, any time you do hold a referendum, there is a cost. There's no doubt about that. This referendum was to be held by the previous government, was to be held by multiple governments. It's gone through a huge amount of different kinds of committees. It was a witness at one myself in the past as a stay-at-home parent. So, you know, what can you say? Do you never put referendums to people because of that cost? I don't know. I think that it's not a good reason not to hold a referendum. Maybe there might be other reasons not to hold it, but it's not a good enough reason not to hold it.
Look, I think it was bunyuk, it was codology. It was the sort of referendum that you hold when everything else has been done. You know, when you've all the houses built, when you've sorted the hospital waiting lists, when the government is doing well and doing their jobs well, then
It's not mutually exclusive, though, Luke.
But it's, I think people felt this was timed in an election year to make the government look progressive, to try and garner support for something that we could all agree on in an election year, and distract from the other conversations that are going on about the failure in housing and health. You know, to eat into media airtime. We've talked about nothing else but the referendum for the past few weeks.
Okay, Senator,
to comment on that. Yeah. Like, I don't get the feeling that this was about government, because, as I say, Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, Labour, People for Profit were all pushing for this referendum. And in fact, the Gender Equality Committee was putting a huge amount of pressure to have this referendum last year, not this year. And this was the earliest, I guess, that they felt that they would have everything lined up. But it wasn't a case of, let's just do this referendum that people have thought up of in their heads. It came off the back of citizens' assemblies, gender equality committees, the previous justice committee. And so it was following through on a commitment, and a commitment in the programme for government as well, which was set 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, because we could keep talking about this for the next 5 hours, but we won't. Senator Pauline O'Reilly and Ains Representative Luke Silk, thank you both for joining us on Galway Talks. Still to come on the programme today, we hear from Lynn O'Loughlin, who has a period townhouse in Galway, and it's featuring in episode 4 of Home of the Year. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. I can tell you the comment lines are absolutely hopping from the referendum chat there. So we'll see if we can get to them between now and the end of the programme as well. But yeah, I just need to read a few of them because some of them I just can't broadcast. But anyways, let's change the tempo a little bit because we're joined in studio by Lynn O'Loughlin because her home features in episode 4 of Home of the Year. Lynn, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'll just bring you in a little bit closer, Lynn. Talk to us about your home. Now, it's based in Salt Hill, and talk to us about why you got involved in Home of the Year.
So I think we were a long time looking for the right property. We were looking for a period home, and we rented for a long time. So it was a long time coming, and I felt we wanted to kind of get involved in it because we had a good collection over the years from artists and makers and creatives in the West and in Ireland. And I'm a lecturer in ATU for the last 20 years. So that collection has moved a lot. And it was a real sense of, that we've got here. It took maybe three and a half years with a lot of renovations, and I suppose, will we ever be finished? I don't know. So it was a nice experience, and I felt it was a good way to use it as a platform to showcase all that talent that we have in the West.
Mm. And it's a beautiful property as well. Just describe it for people who obviously haven't seen the episode yet.
It would be a mid-terrace, about over 100 years old from the front, so it's very, very deceiving. Mm-hmm. It looks quite small, but it's long, and also we have now got a semi-basement. We would have outgrown it very, very fast. We have triplets who are 9, and so they're getting bigger by the day. And I suppose we didn't want to have a big, big house, but we wanted to be in near the sea. Mm. And not to be in cars and not to be commuting. We've got one car and we cycle everywhere. Yeah. So it was, it's very, goes into old into new, I suppose, yeah. So, and hopefully we've kind of married the two together quite nicely.
And how did you find, you mentioned it's a long house. How did that affect the layout and the renovations you made, or what sort of modifications did you made to maximise that space?
Yeah, well, if Kieran was here from Arden Homes, there was a lot of carrying things in through the front door. We've got very good neighbours in the Grafton Hair Studio next door who left us use their side entrance as well. And that causes a lot of problems when you're, kind of in a terrace. It's mid-terrace, but we don't have a back entrance. Out the back now, we've got a really nice area for an outdoor shower and utility. So we've really made the most of what we have. And to the front, we've put in a little small area to put the bikes so that we don't have to bring them in through the house. Mm-hmm. But it caused a lot of issues with access. And I suppose that's probably why it took so long. And it felt like it was such a mammoth job, you know.
And you were involved with plenty of Galway companies on this.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Everything was from, it's local. We've got Cutting Edge Tiles. Arden Homes was the builder, the Door Centre from here, just across the road. Gary Harty did a lot of the bespoke furniture. I feel like I start calling, I'm going to miss people out. But really, I think the artists and, some of them have been my past students over the years. And it's really, really nice for me to be able to see and to support them now.
Mm. A long experience, but did you find it rewarding, or what were the challenges you faced?
Other than the access, it was, COVID as well. It was around that time and things had slowed down. So we had to do the camping stove for a lot longer than we thought. We didn't have a kitchen for over 6 months. We had to move out. We moved back in. We moved out. We were living in the Ardlan Hotel for a week or two at one stage. And with 3 kids, when they walked off to school and you look at them and they were nearly white with the dust every day. So I feel that it was, a great experience. So rewarding. We had moved, 8 times. In the kids are are nine now, so they have names for all the different houses that we lived in. So I really feel that we don't want to move again at the moment. I suppose we never say never, but the location for us is key. We've, you know, Salt Hill Village is just magic. We've got everything on our doorstep. The community is just fabulous. You know, we have we're all big swimmers, big swimming community. And, you know, I feel that you don't need to have these big houses. We don't need to be, you know, spending money trying to heat them. So we've got a really, you know, really good space, a lot of hidden storage, really good heating facilities. You know, it's an aerated house now. And for that over 100 years old is phenomenal, you know, and that's testament to my husband, who's an engineer. And so I suppose we just needed that extra space and we couldn't go up. So we went down, and that's with the semi-basement. So the kids have their own area. So it's a lot quieter now. They have their own area downstairs.
Brilliant. And what was it like hearing the thoughts of the likes of Hugh and Amanda or Sarah?
I know, yeah, it was, it caused quite a stir there back in September, October. I think Hugh was over in O'Connor's getting his apple tart, and he met all the ladies coming out of Bridge, and then the two coffee shops, the guys in Cali and Ray Design were telling me that people were coming in for the coffee and they weren't leaving. So there was a lot of excitement on the road and the cameras and that. So, yeah, you know, I suppose I haven't seen the episode, so I don't know what they've said either. So I hope they've been kind to me.
So we'll have to find out tomorrow night at 8:30 on RT1 and the RT Player as well.
Yes, that's it.
Lynn O'Loughlin, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you so much.
And hopefully we see a positive result tomorrow night. But Lynn, thanks for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on the programme today, we have a member of the Kilfenor Ceilidh Band in with us. It's John Lynch next. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Did I say I'm joined in studio by John Lynch of the Kilfenor Ceilidh Band? John, good morning. Thanks for coming to us this morning.
Good morning, John, and thanks very much for having you. And hello to all the people that are listening to Galway Talks.
Absolutely. You're very busy in the Kilfenora Ceilidh Band as well, and you've a lot of gigs coming up in the next while, including this weekend coming.
Yes, we're very busy. This is a busy time of the year for us. We're in the National Concert Hall on the 16th of March, and then we go on to Kilkenny on the Patrick's Day itself, and then we're back in Leisureland in Salt Hill on Friday the 22nd of March, and we're looking forward to that.
And the doors there is at 8 o'clock, I believe, is
8 p.m.,
it?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
8
p.m. If people do want to go see there, I'll give them the chance now. Just text in the word Ceilidh to 086 38 33 553 to our text and WhatsApp number, and do so straight away. But it's a busy time of year for you, John, and I suppose, do you find that people around this time of year are really looking, they have a hunger for your type of music, particularly going into the Irish celebration of St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, well, the Irish people love to celebrate anyway, John, but Patrick's weekend is a very special weekend. It's our national saint, and people really like to go out over that weekend, and there's lots of festivals all over the country. And our type of music, traditional music, is very popular at that time of the year. Well, throughout the whole year, I think traditional music has become very popular worldwide now. And like, sure, Galway is alive with traditional music, you know, it's one of the hot spots really, and we love coming to Galway and looking forward to it in Leisureland as well. But traditional music, I think worldwide now, John, is very well received, you know, and it's wonderful that it is being received so well internationally. And you have the likes, sure, I mean, Frankie Gavin and Jay Donnan were one of the very early groups that at that time traditional music was under a lot of pressure, and the likes of those groups kept it alive, like, you know.
Brought it to international prominence.
Yeah, they did,
well.
Like, and Dolores singing with him that time, like, they brought it everywhere, as well as Stockton Swing and the Chieftains and the Batty Band now, who are coming around again now, and they're doing concerts as well.
Definitely. And you have a huge amount of members in your band. Just talk us through some of them as well, if you have a
Well, you see, our band originally, my grandfather would have been part of the band originally, John, and the band came together before the word Ceilidh even came into. They came together to raise funds for the church, and they had socials in the local schoolhouse. And then my father and my uncle and my aunt were part of the band in the 1950s, and now I'm part of the band. Like, and the present band line, there's a, you know, when you put on the club jersey, John, like, it's, you're representing your home place, and we're in a small village in the north of Clare, and which is very close to the Galway border anyway, so, like, there's a great sense of putting on the jersey and representing Kilfenora music again. Mm. And like the band has five or six from Kilfenora presently, and then you have people from outside of Kilfenora, and every member that has ever become part of the band has brought a wonderful, they've brought their talents to the band, and the band has developed because of that. And we have Gary Shannon on flute, Anthony Quigley's on flute, Tim Collins on concertina, Claire Griffin on Bert Accordion. You have the Sharon Howley on cello, her sister Eam or on violin, Sinead Hagley on violin, and Marie McCormick on violin, Anne Rin on violin, and you have the drums, Sean Griffin. You have double bass with Brian O'Grady, and you have keyboards with Fintan McMahon. So you have the full spectrum of music is represented within the band. And what we like to do is to challenge ourselves as musicians, because there will be a certain perception of Cayley bands, you see, and we're trying to break that perception to show that there's another side to it as well. Mm. Because we've gone from being just totally a Cayley band to being a concert band as well. Okay. Now, when you're playing for a sit-down audience, it demands a different type of approach to the music you play. And we naturally, everybody knows that the Kilfenora will play jigs and reels, but what they mightn't be aware of is that we do arranged pieces as well. And we have, like when we're in Galway now, for instance, we have your own Don Stiff singing with us, and also mm-hmm. Fiona Ryan will sing with us. And then we have three dancers, Amy Maher, John Fitzgerald, who works here in Galway, wow. but is a world champion step dancer, and Brian Culligan. So our concert is a mix of music, song and dance. So it's not a case of us going up and playing jigs and reels all night. No, the moods change, and with the cello and the double bass and all, you have the wide spectrum of music is represented, the sound, and there's with a big band like that, there's a lovely sound from it. Mm. So that's the way it has evolved.
So you're coming to Leisureland in Galway on Friday the 22nd of March at 8 o'clock, and you've mentioned all that are going to be a part of it as well. But you also mentioned earlier on there about you've diversified your sound. Talk to me about Dinky Doofer.
Yeah, well, Dinky Doofer just is an example of it. Dinky Doofer are two polkas that were composed by Tim Collins, the concertina player in the band, and it shows the versatility of the band and the different things that can be done with the arrangement. And it keeps, because musicians like always like to challenge themselves, John, and they're all the time trying to better. And the same with the Kilfenora. I'm trying to bring the Kilfenora to a wider audience so that they can enjoy our music, and that the because what I find sometimes is you get people that come to our concert, we'll say your age group though, John, mm-hmm. and they bring their parents because their parents are into the Kilfenora, and they give them an eye out and they go with them. But what generally the comments that we get from the younger people then is, God, we never thought that to be like that. And we come again, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to spread the bass and try to show that there's lovely music to be listened to as well as danced to.
Brilliant. Well, John Lynch, thank you for joining us in the studio here on Galway Talks. I'm going to play you out with Dinky Doofer, and we'll be back after news with our Galway greats today, which is Valerie Hughes. Join us then.
Thank you, John.